At Pizza Nova, there's something for every pizza lover. Create your own masterpiece with some of our vegan or vegetarian options that include our dairy-free mozzarella, our gluten-free multigrain dough, and our gourmet vegetarian toppings. Ciao, I'm Dominic Primucci, and I invite you to taste the difference.
439-0444-PIZZA-NOVA.
Expanding on all of the top sports headlines. This is Writer's Block with Jeff Blair and Richard Deitch on Sportsnet 590 The Fan.
Well, Deitch, we made it. It's Friday. They said it couldn't be done, but there you go.
Another one in the books, almost.
One in the books.
3 hours to go.
3 hours. 3 hour tour. This is Writer's Block. It's from Gilligan's Island. Writer's Block with Blair and Deitch. We got a busy show today, man. Travis worked hard on the show.
I like the guess. A lot of you should be happy because a lot of soccer on the show and
it's
two
not,
very
not a lot of soccer.
Well,
because there's going to be
two
people
segments
who are
on
go,
soccer.
There they go talking soccer again. You
and
know,
two
don't do that.
And two very prominent soccer people, which is really good. John Champion. I mean, you'll do the lineup, but John Champion is like to me one of the iconic game callers of his generation. And Grant Walls, you know, fairly preeminent soccer writer in North America. United States? I'm not going to say the world because obviously there's so many great writers from the UK, but I think that's probably fair to say. Most prominent soccer writer in North America?
I've never sat down and listed them, but I would say likely.
All right.
Here's Travis with his lineup. Very nice. Nice timing, Travis. Thank you.
There you go.
What time do we start? What is it? 2 to 5? You know what's on the show. That's true. I do, don't I? Richard Justice is a national baseball writer with MLB.com. He'll join us at 2:25. We'll talk about this situation in Houston. Nolan Ryan basically ending his relationship with the team.
Yeah.
And his son getting one of those wonderful jobs people create for you when they don't want to get rid of you but don't know what to do with you.
Advisor?
Something like that.
Yeah.
Jim Ralph joins us at 3 o'clock. Leafs beat the Golden Knights 2-1 in overtime last night. They'll take on the Flyers on Hockey Night in Canada tomorrow night. And I thought it was the Leafs season of microcosm. 5 to 7 minutes of maybe some of the worst hockey you'll ever witness in your life. Well, remembering very much what happened in the game before this one. Keeping that in mind. Some tremendous goaltending, both by Freddie Anderson and Malcolm Subban. And great goals. Just absolutely great goals. And, the Leafs keep winning, man. They keep winning. There are issues. They're not playing a particularly entertaining brand of hockey. Although, as I said, there were about 35 shots on goal last night by both teams. So it certainly wasn't... it wasn't kitty bar the door. And again, the Leafs, as they showed, are capable of really not doing a great deal then all of a sudden just bringing you out of your seat with some of their raw talent. I mean, this is not a newsflash. It's unbelievable. But you know what, Richard? They're soldiering on. A team with no backup goaltender to speak of. A team that has no clue how to enter the other team's zone in the power play. They figured out a little bit of that last night, but by and large, no clue on how to enter the other team's zone of power play. A team that's had some injury issues, they're just plugging along. And I don't think I ever thought we'd have to see this team plug along, but I think as Mike Babcock said yesterday, they're getting points.
Yeah, listen, last night was a really, really strange game. It almost felt like two different teams on the ice. I mean, two different Leafs teams on the ice at times. Like you mentioned, there was that stretch. I don't know how long it was, without a shot. I mean, again, just so much talent on that team and just stretches where offensively they don't exist. To me, Jeff, and again, I am sure someone out there probably can counter with another game. That's the best game I've ever seen Freddie Anderson play in regular season.
Oh, wow.
I'm not saying in terms of importance, it was close to the most important game. But he looked spectacular to me. He was so on point in terms of, particularly in the third period and in overtime. That to me looked like a guy who's the best goalie in the league. And I realize that's all subjective, but I thought he was awesome. The other thing, I was talking to Brian Burke in the newsroom before. Austin Matthews, I felt like, had a statement game. Like every shift, I thought he was excellent. And so there were some positive signs. And Muzzin, I thought, played really well too. But like you mentioned, Jeff, there's also moments there where just like it's a massive disappearing act. William Nylander still, to me, is just the most one of the most confounding players on that entire team.
Well, it's possible he may not be that good.
Yeah, I mean, I don't want to say that, but it's...
Or it's possible that he's
not impactful at all.
Exactly. I wouldn't say a spare part, but I think when you look at the team and you look at the offensive talent that team has, sometimes he just appears to be kind of a hood ornament.
Yeah, I mean, he's got
a hood ornament
on
a really expensive car.
So you can't give up on him, and obviously he's got the contract. But again, like, I mean, I hate to sort of equate it to what you are paid and expectations, but there's just stretches, Jeff, where he has no impact on the game, which is just kind of stunning given where he is salary-wise. And again, lastly, Cody Ceci. I don't know when that experiment in terms of many minutes for him ends, but we have to be getting close, I think.
Well, it's not really, I don't know if you'd say it's an experiment. I mean, he was acquired to be one of their top defensemen. Or in terms of minutes, it's not really an experiment. It's not like there's a lot of options there. I mean, I suppose you could give Justin Hall more minutes.
I think he's played better.
He has played better. Travis Dermott disappeared at times last night, both literally and also physically. I don't know how many minutes he had in the second period, but I can find out because
I still give him a little bit of a pass because he's coming back.
But Cody Ceci is what Cody Ceci was in Ottawa. And he's a guy that's going to drive you nuts. There's a second period here. What am I looking for?
Minutes.
I am looking for minutes. Travis Dermott. Okay, he had 6 shifts in the first period, played 5 minutes. 4 shifts in the second period, played 3 minutes and 20 seconds. Now, part of that, of course, is because the power plays and special teams, you know, sort of made it difficult to get in the flow. But, look, I Cody Ceci and Morgan Riley together aren't anywhere near as effective as Ron Hainsey and Morgan Riley were last year. They're not.
I agree.
And I don't know if Cody Ceci's dragging Morgan Riley's game down with him. I think, as Elliot Friedman has suggested, there's something up with Morgan Riley. He doesn't look... I wouldn't say he doesn't look as fast as he's looked in the past. He looks more aware of imminent contact than he has in the past. He's playing like a guy who's hurt, a guy who's trying to protect something. And that's, you know, I'm not taking anything away from him, and that just is what it is. But, you know, there was a play last night. It was Carrier. I just swung around Cody Ceci, and it's like Cody Ceci was just grasping at air. He's getting responsible minutes. He's getting a lot of responsible minutes. He's playing a lot of responsible situations. But I think you're right. I wouldn't call it an experiment, but I think at some point you have to ask yourself, does Cody Ceci really deserve all those minutes that he's getting? And at this point, no. At this point, he has to prove to me that he deserves those minutes that he's getting.
The maybe experiment's not the best word, but the change of scenery or the hope that the change of scenery would change things has not worked. I don't know at a certain point when you sort of shut the door on, you know, first four defensive pairing minutes. So, but again, you know, you mentioned a win's a win, and like they're picking up points, and they got a little bit of an unbeaten stretch going, and that's important. You know, back at least in terms of the conference, back in the top eight, and so these are the games you got to pick up points on. And Vancouver, I'm sorry, Vegas is a good team. Again, I'm talking to Brian Burke in the newsroom. Something is up with them. They haven't gotten off to the sort of the start they expected, but that's a quality group.
Jim Ralph will join us at 3:00. You know, one of the things I want to ask Jim is we've had a lot of and there's been a lot of discussion in the city about the Leafs power play, which was, you know, by and large, again, gruesome last night. They were 2 for 26 in their last six games at one point.
Wow.
But people look at the talent in that power play, especially that first power play unit. And, you know, you put yourself in Mike Babcock's position. Mike Babcock is hearing voices telling him that he's got to change up that first unit. He knows that. Everybody's talking about it. Everybody's criticizing the first unit. The second unit is okay, but the first unit's basically been doing the same stuff now for the past month or so. And it's doing it even with John Tavares back. It was doing it when John Tavares was gone. They're running out the same unit. They're doing the same thing. They're having the same issues gaining entry into the other team's zone, all that good stuff. But I thought about this last night, and I wondered, the Leafs have a new power play coach, and Mike Babcock made the point about a new voice, you know, and players getting used to a new voice. And I'm wondering if maybe what we aren't seeing is Mike Babcock kind of deciding that, look, I can do two things here. I can give into the criticism and urge that we change up the first unit, in which case people are going to be saying, oh, the power play coach had to react to all the criticism, or I can show faith in the new guy and just stick with it until it works and believe that it's going to work. You know, so maybe he's erring on the side that way of supporting one of his coaches.
You know,
that's a possibility.
If there's one optimistic element to last night, it would be, Jeff, the power play looked better late. And I read some of the quotes coming out of the dressing room afterwards. And Matthews and Marner both sort of said, I don't really know how you sort of quantified exactly, but they sort of said that they didn't overthink those last couple power plays. They're sort of more improvisational.
Yeah, it was more, I think Austin Matthews' line was, we just kind of took it on ourselves.
Yeah, and the puck moved better.
Which is good, but on the other hand.
What have you been doing, you know, right?
Yeah. It's good, but what does that say? What does that say about the instruction you've been getting? Look, I think at times, you know, you can set up, you can call timeouts and you can set up your power play and you can draw it up in diagrams and all that good stuff. But at some point, I think your players just have to essentially assume the responsibility of making the damn thing work. There's enough talent out there. There's enough talent capable of playing in enclosed areas and small areas. There's playing in tight around the net that you should be able to figure something out.
Yeah, the one thing I would say, and again, I cede my hockey knowledge to many other people here, but the one thing the eye test does tell you, Jeff, is if you watch some of the other really skilled teams in the league, Boston, Washington, the puck on the power play, Jeff, just moves better, crisper. There's more opportunities, and the Leafs have that kind of skill.
It is
stagnant, and particularly stagnant in terms of entry zone.
I was going to say into
the power play.
Yeah, I'm not entirely certain it's all that stagnant once they're in the zone. It's getting into the zone where they have an annoying habit of running into each other.
Yeah,
and I don't know. Is it a product of having so many skilled players in the power play, so many offensive players in the power play,
kind of thing?
Yeah, that everybody's worried about being selfish and, you know, looking to set up the other guy. There were a lot of opportunities last night. Plays right in front of the net, and Andreas Janssen in particular is guilty of this. Plays right in front of the net where there was a back pass or that desire to make, you know, to maybe, and I get the point of wanting to improve your shooting angle and improve the shooting lane and all that, but sometimes put the puck in the net instead of looking to make that other pass. And that's something that I think the Leafs are guilty of. But again, you know, we make the point, November 8th, they've played some hard games. Last night's game was hard in that they were playing a good team. They were playing a big team. They were playing a team that tried to hit them just like LA tried to hit them and did hit them, as a matter of fact. And you know what? They got out of there.
Yeah.
They got out of there with the overtime win. And last night, give credit where credit was due, they won a goaltending battle against a team that should be one of the top four teams in the other conference. that's not bad, you know, and taken in a, just in a bubble, like just taken as a small sample size. If the rest of this season had kind of gone the way we expected it to go, or there weren't all these crises, we'd be looking at last night's win and saying, that's a hell of a win, man. Yeah. I mean, the game was there to be lost, but your goalie stayed, that the other team's goalie was off the charts good. You missed some shots, all this stuff, but you persevered. You won it in overtime. Two of your best offensive players came through in overtime, all this stuff. If you could just sort of put that game in a bubble, you go, that's a good win. That's a win that a potential Stanley Cup champion pulls off in the middle of the season. But you've got to view it in light of what, you know, of what's happened in the lead up to it.
Yeah, it's a you're right. If we looked at this as a one-off, it's a good one-off. In the larger context, it's different. Just two quick things I wanted to add is one, Malcolm Subban, like you said, was awesome. And that, again, gives you the indication of the value of a backup goalie. I mean, that's a guy who's going to win games for that team and steal some points. The second thing is the Leafs are really good 4-4, Jeff. That is the one thing that I've sort of has been pretty consistent this season. And I realize you don't always get those opportunities, but man, like when the ice is a little freer and there's one less body or two less bodies in this case on the ice, you really see the skill level of that team, particularly when Marner and Matthews or Tavares and Marner or Tavares and Matthews can get together. Really high skill.
We'll have more Leafs discussion with Jim Ralph at 3 o'clock. Grant Wall, we mentioned, will join us ahead of TFC's MLS Cup date Sunday in Seattle against the Seattle Sounders. John Champion will have the call of the game on ESPN. Richard mentioned he'll join us. Dan Wojcicki is the national basketball writer with the LA Times. He'll be along to talk a little bit about the Lakers and the Clippers, with the Raptors, of course, getting ready for back-to-back games in LA after they played a night in New Orleans. Kawhi Leonard, or I should say the Clippers, getting nailed with a $50,000 fine over talking about load management.
Right.
And essentially, the team decided not to play Kawhi Leonard against the Bucks, citing load management, suggesting there was an injury issue. Doc Rivers, God love him, the head coach of the Clippers, just kind of said, yeah, he's fine. Kawhi is okay. So the NBA got its you-know-what tied up in a knot, no doubt, with the announcers, with the national networks sort of making a couple of phone calls here and there. So the Clippers are fined $50,000. But here's where I have an issue with this, with this whole thing. I don't want to get into load management because we kind of flogged that horse a couple of days ago. But in its release, the NBA identified what Kawhi Leonard's injury issue was and came out and stated it's a patellar injury.
Mm.
Now, I'm not a big fan. I understand if you say we're fining the team $50,000 because, you know, we have reason to believe yada, 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 yada. I'm not a big fan of the league coming out and telling people what a guy has. That, quite frankly, is not your opponent's business. Now, I'm not saying guys are going to go out there and, you know, go full-scale Tanya Harding on Kawhi Leonard the next time they see him, you know, have somebody out there with a hammer looking for his knee or anything like that. But the point is, I'm not a fan of that. I don't think that's the league's place.
Yeah, it was surprising. I saw that note in that statement.
And I wondered, Richard, if that isn't Adam Silver sort of firing a shot across the bow of all his teams and saying, look, I'll play along with you to a certain degree on this.
I think it is.
But don't get cute. Because if you get cute, we're going to come out with this stuff. And where this really gets interesting, and it's something that, you know, we had David Sampson on a couple of months ago talked about this in a different context. We're getting to a point where there is going to be formal relationships between legalized gambling and sports teams.
That's what this is.
It is going to be, again, it doesn't matter because I'm not gambling. I don't care to me. You pay your money, you take your chances. But there is going to be an understanding that you are going to have to be open about injuries. It's a matter of consumer confidence, if you want to call it that, for gamblers. And it's the same reason we're seeing baseball teams allegedly, and I don't know if they do it, but supposedly they're going to have to or do have to announce their their starting lineups the night before.
Yeah, that's where I think Silver did it.
And that's where this is.
I think he's aiming. I think he's using transparency as both one to alert the marketplace to know that this is the kind of stuff mm-hmm. we're going to do. But secondly, Jeff, which you hit on, I think he's letting all those franchises know that, hey, like, we're going to be in a real relationship formally with these gambling entities, and like, this is now pro forma. Like, right. we are telling people what the injury is. The league, the teams obviously don't want that. Where it's going to get really fascinating is when the team gives the league information that maybe isn't accurate, and that's coming.
Oh, I
because what if absolutely. I'm Doc Rivers and Lawrence Frank and Steve Ballmer, why on earth do I want anyone to know?
No. Absolutely.
Kawhi Leonard's health. It doesn't help my franchise one iota.
You know, and I mean, I know we're up against the clock here, but it impacts your ability to get insurance for players.
Yeah.
I mean, there's a ton of stuff. Like, look, we all love transparency.
Game planning. I don't want those
game
guys
planning.
To game
exactly.
plan.
Right, yeah. Exactly. So there are a couple of things that work there. Anyhow, we'll talk to Dan about that. It's again, it's an interesting story beyond the whole notion of load management. We were going to have Richard Justice on, but he had to cancel, so I'm going into the bullpen for a closer. Ben Nicholson-Smith will join us. We'll have some off-season Jays talk, take a look ahead to free agency, and we'll talk a little bit about what the hell is going on with Houston as well. We knew that because of the incident with Brandon Taubman that the Astros front office was going to be under the microscope this offseason, but I don't know if anybody really expected to see Nolan Ryan end his relationship with the organization. Nolan Ryan is basically the face of baseball in Texas. So it's not, I guarantee it's not a move Nolan made lightly, and it's a move that probably resonated and probably cut really deeply to a lot of people who are Astros fans. Ben Nicholson-Smith is next. It's Writer's Block on Sportsnet 590 The Fan and Sportsnet 360.
Now, more Writer's Block on Sportsnet 590 The Fan.
Derek Brandeo's guilty pleasure. Derek Brandeo's guilty pleasure day for putting together the playlist. He's our technical director. You can't hear it on TV because there's some sort of CRTC type thingish going on. But anyhow, so it's he played Cher. If I could turn back time,
oof,
that video's a guilty pleasure.
That's impressive. That's a good one by him.
That video's a
I didn't think
pleasure.
I would see Cher in any list, but...
What could go wrong?
It's a quality start.
What could go wrong? Cher with a big military gun on a boat full of sailors? Come on.
That's a good opener. That's a Rays opener. Successful.
Ben Nicholson-Smith is baseball editor at sportsnet.ca, and he joins us. Thank you so much. Our friend Richard Justice had to pull the plug. And I shouldn't rephrase, pull the plug. Probably found something better to do, to be quite honest, knowing Richard. No, Richard is an honorable person, and we brought Ben Nicholson-Smith in. Thank you so much for doing this. It's nice that you just happened to be in the building.
I am happy to be here.
You were podcasting today with Mr. Zwelling, correct?
Exactly. We did a little At the Letters recording, so we've already talked some baseball today, but it's not out yet. So this is the first chance that I really get to talk baseball.
All right. When is the podcast going to drop?
Hopefully soon.
What's the subject? Right. What'd you guys talk?
Jay's off-season preview. Trying to basically forecast what's going to happen next, which kind of is an interesting discussion.
Okay.
All right. What's going to happen next?
More pitching. I think honestly, they're going to add another pitcher and then another one after that and then probably another one after that. Like, even though the Chase Anderson deal is a nice one that I think is pretty low downside and might help them, they still need 2-3 more starting pitchers
right.
at this point.
So... What is realistic, honestly, for Chase Anderson? We had him on. Thought he was a really interesting guy. Went to some places in that interview, including his faith, that normally you don't hear from pro athletes. But, you know, you look at his stats, and it's kind of a weird evaluation. 2017 was a good year. But then 2018, not as good. And then if you go a little deeper in terms of the analytics and the pitches, like certain pitches were just getting wrecked. Like, you have any feel as to what... he might be here, change the league, change the stadium, et cetera?
Yeah, I mean, you look at the track record there, and overall it's pretty good. Man, pitching in the AL East for a guy who's had home run issues, yeah. I'm not expecting that he's going to go through the year unblemished on that front, but, I mean, no one does. It's such a hard division. So I think that, you know, Anderson's comments were pretty interesting as far as talking about the curveball and how he wants to get a feel for that. If he does, then that could be a nice, you know, fourth pitch for him, along with the cutter, changeup, and fastball. So he's got the weapons. I think most importantly, he brings some durability, some stability, and I think that's what the Jays needed. I mean, we saw way too much Edwin Jackson, way too much Ryan Feuerbend last year, and just anyone who can push them away from that to something more palatable mm-hmm. is going to be a step in the right direction.
You really want him. You want him to stay healthier than Matt Shoemaker did, but essentially that's kind of what you're looking at here. I mean, Matt Shoemaker is Matt Shoemaker, but I would have taken a healthy year of Matt Shoemaker in terms of providing stability. And I think that's, it's if you're Charlie Montoyo and Pete Walker, you just want somebody that you know what they're going to give you when you send them out there. You know the good, you know the bad, but you aren't necessarily flipping a coin with a guy. And that's what guys like Chase Anderson are.
Exactly. And I mean, it sounds almost like the expectations are being lowered when we put it like that. But in fact, compared to what we saw last year, yeah. this is such an upgrade, right? To have major league starting pitchers. And, you know, the Jays aren't at the point that they have a full rotation of these guys. They have a lot of work ahead of them this offseason. But if they do go out and add two or three more guys along these lines, whether it's Kyle Gibson or Jake Odorizzi or Tanner Roark, whoever it ends up being, then they'll be far ahead of where they were in 2019.
Ben, do you think right now, if you had to put out a sure starting five for the Blue Jays, and I'm not sure you could, are Chase Anderson and Trent Thornton at the moment the only two starters where you could say these are starters? I get Baruchy and I get others, but I look around and like that's pretty much, I don't even know if I should call them a sure thing, but they're the closest to a sure thing that the organization has, which then obviously sort of advances the conversation. Like how many starters do they realistically have to bring in?
I think it's at least two more. I really do. I mean, if they just go out and add one more starter, I think that would be a very disappointing offseason at this point. I think it has to be minimum two more. And I don't just mean bounce back types like a Michael Walker, but I think you really have to be talking about established major league pitchers who are coming off full and relatively healthy seasons. You know, maybe you mix in a Michael Pineda, someone with a red flag or a yellow flag as far as the drug suspension. Maybe it's someone coming off a down year like a Rick Porcello. But either way, you're talking about someone with a track record or multiple guys with track records of success in the majors.
Yeah.
Now, you'll be going to the general manager's meetings in Arizona. Is it next week? It is next week, right?
Yes, Monday to Thursday.
Monday to Thursday. You and Shai will be down there for Sportsnet. So keep your eyes on sportsnet.ca for all the breaking news. We've seen these meetings in the past lay the groundwork for some deals. It was sort of the start of the deal that saw the Jays end up airlifting Jose Reyes and Mark Burley and Josh Johnson. That was a deal that was concocted. I believe it was concocted at Larry Beinfest's room at
wow.
Saddleback. They were Camelback. Nice detail. Camelback or whatever, wherever the hell they were. Are you expecting a slow, deliberate offseason, a slow, glacial offseason, or maybe an offseason where we will see a lot of moves quickly and then nothing until spring training?
I you know, when you look major league wide, I think the presence of Scott Boras just leads me to think that this will be a slow one. When you look at Anthony Rendon and
Garrett
Steven
Cole,
Strasburg.
He's got everybody. Basically.
Everybody. Moustakas, Hyunjin Ryu. I mean, they have so many of the top players out there are Boras guys. And he is someone who historically will wait and wait mm-hmm. and wait. And it's worked for him. So I think that in all likelihood, we see those guys waited out. But, you know, the Jays have been so cautious and so deliberate. And that's not going to change. They're led by cautious and deliberate, meticulous people. So that's what we're going to see. But when they have this many needs, I don't think that you can wait until the very end. Right. I think in November, I won't be surprised at all if in a couple of weeks they've added another starting pitcher.
Yeah, I think, I don't expect them to be players in the market for any of those big-name free agents. But the issue that creates is that you will be dealing with teams who are or who think they're players in that market. And if the free agent market goes slowly, that tends to make the teams with serious interest in that move a little slowly. The only way you get them off that is to quite often pay too much for what you need. So this is the pace of this offseason is going to be really fascinating for me, because I'm with you. I think they add another pitcher right away, but I don't know if it's the big guy right away, you know, or the main guy right away.
Right. I don't think it'll be Jake Odorizzi, you know, next week, but I wouldn't be stunned if it was Wade Miley or Tanner Roark. I really wouldn't. Mm-hmm. And, you know, that's probably a situation where the Jays are going to have to overpay a little bit, because AL East, for one, a 95 loss team last year. And if they want to, you know, pass teams like the Angels or teams like the Yankees or Dodgers who are out there looking for starting rotation help, then I do think it probably does mean paying a little bit extra.
Mm. Ben, we talk so much about the pitching and certainly the adds that are needed in that space. Any thoughts in terms of the Jays, either by trade or by free agent acquisition, adding an outfielder if the price point works for them?
I think they have to be in that part of the market, because, you know, you look at center field, and, you know, my impression is that if the Blue Jays have their best case scenario offseason, that would include a center fielder of some kind. And it's tricky, right? Because you look at the free agent center fielders out there, and they tend to be 31, 32 years mm-hmm. old. Their legs aren't what they were 7 or 8 years ago at that point. So free agency is a tough spot to upgrade center field, but I do think they're going to have trade talks about center fielders. And you might look to Japan and see if there are some. There is one free agent whose name is escaping me now, but they're going to take a look at those guys to try to improve center field, because, I mean, Jeff, we've talked about this a lot, but they just didn't have good enough defense there last year.
No, it was not good at all, and I just. As you're talking, I'm kind of making mental notes, and I've done this a lot early in the off season, just sort of list priorities and everything. I don't see how they can possibly address all those priorities by free agency. I mean, it seems to me at some point you're going to look at this team having to move somebody. You know, Ken Giles is the obvious guy. Listen, I think other than Lourdes Gurriel Jr., Vladdy, Bo, and maybe Danny Jansen. I don't even know if I'd include him in that category. I listen on anybody. I mean, if somebody wants to talk to me, if somebody's interested in Craig Biggio, I listen on that as well. Somebody's interested in Randall Grichuk, I don't know if they would be, but I listen on that as well.
Yeah, the catchers are an interesting one because they could certainly be of interest, both Reese McGuire and Danny Jansen. I do think you're going to have to trade from, maybe it's prospect depth.
Maybe.
I don't think that they're going to trade their top guys, but they do have a lot of players in that system. And that's, you know, if there's a discrepancy in how the Jays value them and some team is really high on a guy that they mm-hmm. don't particularly like, then go for it. So I think they are going to have to trade. The pitching, I think, comes from free agency. Mm-hmm. But if they add meaningfully to the center field position, I think that might have to come through the trade market.
Ben, when you look at the division, it's very clear that the Yankees will still be in a pretty advantageous position. Tampa Bay is excellent. The Red Sox have a serious issue. They have problems all over the place. Again, it's maybe a little crazy to sort of say this in November the year before, but it strikes me that I think the division may play out next year exactly how it plays out this year, because I don't know if the Red Sox problems are solvable in one offseason.
Yeah, the Red Sox are such an interesting team. I think if you're looking at it league-wide, you know, taking ourselves outside of the Toronto bubble a little bit, that's absolutely the team that's the most interesting in this division, because, you know, they have a new GM, Chaim Bloom, who's just hired, and the decision around Mookie Betts is super fascinating to me, because this is a guy who's a perennial MVP candidate. Probably, you know, him and Alex Bregman are probably the two best players in baseball, not named Mike Trout. So do you really trade him, even if he only has 1 year left? I mean, I think if you're the Red Sox, you just have to hold on. But they might arrive at a different conclusion.
Speaking of general managers, there's a report. It's probably not a great surprise that Ben Cherington, one of the Blue Jays senior advisors, is that his title? He's senior something. Very high up in the decision-making apparatus with the Blue Jays, that he is a candidate for the job in Pittsburgh. Now, we know that in the past, Ben has turned down opportunities. I believe he turned down an opportunity interview for the Mets last year, if I'm not mistaken. And which is interesting, because his wife still works in New York, and her family's from around there. But do you see him? Like, Pittsburgh would seem to be from a distance, people look at it and go, Pittsburgh's a mess. And, but you could also see a guy like Ben Cherington go in there, a team that's already analytics savvy. I mean, it is. It's got the analytics grounding. It's got the infrastructure. I think a guy like Ben Cherington could do really well in Pittsburgh.
Absolutely. You can see why they're interested. And I don't claim to know what would motivate him or what he would want to do. But that in itself is almost telling because he's been around this team for 3 years now, right?
Mm-hmm.
But when I say around this team, he's not a visible presence. He's not someone who's
his voice is very loud.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. His voice is. But, you know, I wonder if a smaller market like Pittsburgh, in contrast to Boston, where he was first a GM and it's a fishbowl constantly, you win a World Series, you're still out of there as GM, as both he and Dombrowski experienced. Like, I wonder if a place like Pittsburgh might be, you know, back to baseball. It's all about baseball in a place like that. You just try to win, and that's your project without being pulled down by all these different distractions.
Before we let you run, I did want to ask you about the Houston Astros. You know, the news yesterday that Nolan Ryan's ending his relationship with his team. His son has been shuffled around. This is the team that has made its mark as a very analytically savvy team, a team that invests heavily in R&D. We know about the issues within that front office as well, based on what we saw in the World Series. But my question to you is, does this shift, is this sort of more almost a cosmetic shift, or is there something philosophical we may be seeing at work here that might impact on the field?
Right. Yeah. I mean, it seems like it's business side for how it's been described. But you never know how it might be described or how it might manifest on the field. I think
because Nolan's a huge personality in that, not in baseball, not just in that market.
Absolutely. And I think even to this day, like it's almost weird, but sometimes players who are too young to have seen him pitch will like cite Nolan Ryan as one of their favorite all time pitchers, which
very
is like
true.
I don't know how he quite pulled that one off, but it's impressive. So to sever ties with someone like that is a big decision. But then again, we haven't exactly come to know the Astros as a team with a great personal touch for this kind of thing.
No, that's true. You're right. It's always fascinated me about Nolan Ryan. When you talk to players, you talk to pitchers, you know, who's your idol? And they always talk about this in the scene. And then Nolan Ryan, you go, come on, you're too young to have seen him. But you know what? But there's a lore surrounding Nolan Ryan that, I mean, how many other pitchers... Maybe Roger to a certain degree, Roger Clemens maybe, but Nolan is sort of the, like if you just, he's one of those guys, if you describe a pitcher as being Nolan Ryan, like you get an instant detailed picture of what the guy is.
Oh yeah. You know,
the only other pitcher I can remember, people would say this guy reminds me very much of Bob Gibson. You got that instant detail of what they look like. Ben, thanks so much for doing this. I really appreciate it. Again, Ben Nicholson-Smith and Shai Davidi will be in Phoenix.
Yeah,
outside of Phoenix.
Outside of Phoenix, yeah.
We'll be in Phoenix next week for general managers meeting. Sportsnet.ca will be your destination for all the information. And I'm sure you know, Ben, that you'll be getting a call from us as well.
Looking forward to it. Thanks, guys.
Thanks, Ben.
You'll just be spending all your time hanging around the lobby anyhow.
I will be in a lobby. I can almost guarantee you that I'll be in a lobby when I take your call.
Yeah. Hopefully they've got a good lobby set up. We'll take a break and be back with more Writer's Block on Sportsnet 590 The Fan and 360.
Now, more Writer's Block on Sportsnet 590 The Fan.
Reminder that Jim Ralph, Maple Leafs radio analyst, will join us at 3 o'clock. Grant Wall, SI National soccer writer, host of the Planet Football podcast, be along at 3:25. And Wojcik, is it Wojcik or Wojcik?
I'm not sure, actually. I think it's Wojcik, but we'll ask.
Wojcik. National basketball writer with the LA Times, 4 o'clock. John Champion, MLS play-by-play voice on ESPN 425. Toronto FC and the Seattle Sounders will meet in the MLS Cup on Sunday. And we'll talk to both Grant and John about that. Interesting discussion with Ben Nicholson-Smith just before the break. Talking about some of the things we expect to see from the Toronto Blue Jays this offseason or the to-do list for the Blue Jays this offseason. And it really is extensive. I mean, that goes without, I mean, that, you know, Captain Obvious here. But, you know, there's a lot to do and there's a lot of ground to make up if you want to realistically picture, or if you realistically picture yourself as a team that can contend this season. Like, there is, you know, 15, 20 wins. I don't know where that's going to come from.
I mean, I got one of the interesting things for me will be to see the term that they ultimately give some of these acquisitions, including the pitchers. And will they try to time it, Jeff, where, you know, you give somebody 3 years because you think, you know, 2 years from now you're a serious contender? Or will some of these guys, as Ben mentioned, will there be shorter term deals but for more money? You know, like, it's impossible to sort of determine, like, whether a Chase Anderson is going to be part of this team's sort of timing in the future. My thought would be no, but at a certain point, you do got to make these acquisitions for pitching and hope you can time it to, what, you know, 2021 or 2022 when you expect the team to be good.
Well, I think one of the things you have to see this year is you have to see where Nate Pearson is.
Yeah.
And you have to see, let's be clear, Nate Pearson is going to be on an innings limit. We're going to be talking about load management with Nate Pearson an awful lot. And that's okay. But in the process of the load management, you need to get a handle on what you can realistically expect from him next year. Not this season, but the season after.
Right.
And I really do believe that given the way this organization has kind of viewed things. Look, Vlady Guerrero Jr. is going to be a terrific player. Bo Bichette is going to be a spectacular player. Maybe they'll both be spectacular. Maybe they'll both be terrific. But, I mean, they're going to have long, you know, knock on wood, long careers. But with all due respect, in the case of Vlady Jr., that is an earth-shattering. People have been expecting that. There's a difference between producing prospects, position prospects, and handling starting pitching and breaking starting pitching, young starting pitching into the majors, and trying to do so where you can maximize the pitcher's value to your team, where you can line up his window with your window of opportunity for contending, line up his development to coincide with that. I mean, all the stuff that goes into ensuring that a guy comes from the minors. And let's be clear, 2 years down the road, Nate Pearson probably has to be the best pitcher on this staff for this team to have a chance.
I agree.
There can't be any one. He has to be basically where Aaron Sanchez was when Aaron Sanchez had that great year. That's essentially where he has to be. I think Nate Pearson determines everything as far as timetable goes.
Totally agree. He's the most important person in the organization.
Without question.
I don't think
there's any doubt about that.
And he determines, I think, the future of management too. Let's be honest.
Absolutely.
How goes Ross and Mark?
If he comes in and everything goes smoothly and he hits the ground running, and he has, you know, one of those really good rookie pitching seasons. Guerrero, Bichette, him, Gurriel. I mean, it's hard not to look at Shapiro and Atkins and say they deserve extensions if that works out.
He will determine
a lot of
so
people.
Much.
A lot of people have a lot. A lot of people have a lot invested in Nate Pearson. Jim Ralph is our Maple Leafs radio analyst on Sportsnet 590. The Fan, back to back this weekend for the Leafs. Philly tomorrow night, Chicago Sunday. We've got both games on Sportsnet 590. The Fan. We'll be back with more Writer's Block.
Unconfirmed sources say this is the best show in the history of sports radio.
You're simply the best.
This is Writer's Block with Jeff Blair and Richard Deitch.
Better than all the rest.
On Sportsnet. Sportsnet 590 The Fan.
Hey, welcome back to Writer's Block for Friday. Richard Deitch and Jeff Blair. I want to give a shout out, by the way. My mother turns 95 today, and I know she's watching on TV.
Hey, happy birthday. Awesome.
Happy birthday. 95.
That's amazing. Even in today's day and age, with better health and medicine, et cetera, that's a monster number.
It's a lot of years.
It's amazing. 95. Just think of everything she's lived through.
Including me.
Yeah, including you.
Literally.
But just, you know, from conflict to wars to inventions, that's amazing.
Anyhow, happy birthday, Mom.
She listening?
Yeah, she's listening and watching right now.
Awesome.
Got a new TV in her new apartment, so she's all set.
Wave. I'm waving.
It's either us or curling, which is one of our properties anyhow. So she'll probably be, I'm sure she'll be flipping back and forth. Curling on Sportsnet Ontario right now, if you're interested. Jim Ralph is our Leafs radio analyst on Sportsnet 590, The Fan. Hello, Mr. Ralph. How you doing?
My mother has no idea what I do.
Oh, yes, she does. Come on.
She just keeps sending a note saying, so the hockey thing didn't work out. Yeah.
My son is still a goalie. What were we talking about last night in the elevator? It reminded you of that night in Kalamazoo or something like that, watching Freddie Anderson?
Yeah, no, it's funny. I mean, I always have fun with that line because of, you know, especially if you're in these golf tournaments, which I do a lot of in the off season, and if you meet your group and if you use that line, if they laugh, you know, you're in for a good time in the group. they look at you like you're some idiot. They're going, I don't know. Kalamazoo game. Then you're in for a long 4 or 5 hours.
Yeah, they're going, oh, yeah. And you realize at that time these guys have no idea.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, the other group's got Daryl Sittler and Wendell Clark, and we got some idiot that's talking about the Kalamazoo game in 84.
That's funny.
Hey, Jim, we talked a little bit about this actually last night as well, but, I tried to make the point a little earlier that if you just sort of look at that game by itself and look at the result, and, you know, you won a game where the other team's goaltender was amazing, the other team is a pretty good team, they've got great special teams, yada, yada, et cetera, et cetera. If you look at that as a standalone game, you're probably thinking, boy, that's a good win for the Leafs. But and I know that there was that, you know, a little bit of that talk afterwards, but there's enough underlying concerns with this team that one win isn't going to eradicate it, is it?
Well, unless it's the starting point. I mean, for the first time this year, they win three in a row. No mind, Freddie Anderson had a lot to do with the extra points, whether it was overtime last night or the shootout win in Philadelphia. But I think from having watched every game this year, this is the hardest they work. I thought they were much better battles in front of the net, and there weren't a lot of rebound opportunities. CeCe had the one gaff standing on a clearing attempt, but was still in the right position to make the right play. I just thought all ends of the rink that they battled. Mm-hmm. And, without Freddie Anderson, we're not talking about how great the battles were. But I just thought it was a game that they dug in. And, they won a lot of battles in their own end, a lot of battles in the corner. What Vegas had, they had some clear-cut opportunities, especially in the power play late. You know, and in the last 5 seconds, I think Anderson made 3 saves. But for the most part, I thought it was a game, you know, from the likes of Jake Muzzin or Austin Matthews that they went to war, which mm-hmm. is, you know, more of a playoff-style game, not to get too far ahead of ourselves, but the kind of game that I think you have to dig through to win more if you get to the postseason.
Now, Jim, I'm glad you brought up Muzzin. I thought he was great, breaking up plays. He really was effective.
He was a monster, yeah.
I wanted to ask you about the power play. This is something Jeff and I spoke about a little bit earlier. The comments out of the Maple Leafs dressing room was really interesting about the last couple of power plays when they just sort of discussed that, I guess they just amongst themselves, maybe they sort of stopped overthinking the power play and reacted more. And I wonder if, you know, given you have seen every game this year, Was there something specific that you saw with the last two power plays that were dramatically different than the struggles that they've had earlier?
No, I mean, even, you know, Matthews getting the puck to the net from the right wing circle instead of looking for the perfect play. One of the things they don't have, and you might have to go as far back as Brian McCabe, they don't have the big shot from above the top of the circle. You know, Matthews has a great wrist shot, a great release, you know, from the faceoff dot. But they don't have, you look at Tampa, they've got Kucherov, Stamkos, and Hedman can all do it, you know, the one-timer. So I think what happens is because they don't have that element, they become very predictable. And I think what they've what they get caught doing is everybody standing still. And I thought there might have been a little more movement. You know, and I think Marner's really got to be the trigger man for that, to start to draw guys to him and find some open space somewhere else. I mean, even with the Matthews goals, I think it was Braden McNabb lost his stick. And then it was actually passed his stick from a forward because he broke his and he lost it and actually went behind the net to get it when Matthews let the shot go from the right wing circle. So it was probably more of a 5-on-3 at that point than a regular power play. But I just think that sometimes if you can keep it simple and you say, you know what, throw the puck to the net and look for the rebound or look for the deflection. You don't always have to, as Pat Quinn used to call it, pass the puck into the net.
Jim, the other thing I wondered about the power play is with Paul McFarland, new to this team as its coach, there's been a lot of criticism or a lot of suggestions that, you know, Mike Babcock needs to change it up, needs to, you know, maybe put Tyson Barrie out there just to change the personnel on the power play. And I was wondering if maybe part of what Mike Babcock's doing, people are saying Mike Babcock's stubborn, but maybe part of it too is, you know, he's kind of laying a marker down for his new coach and saying, you know what, I'm going to back this guy up right now. I'm going to back this guy up. I don't want to create anything. You know, we'll keep doing this. Do you think there might be an element of that there? Because Mike knows this city. And, you know, if you make the change and it works out, the next question is, well, what the hell took you so long?
Yeah, we've been telling you that for weeks.
Exactly.
You know, yeah. But I think the other part of it is, I mean, you look at the talent they've got in the power play.
Yeah. Who are you taking off?
And I mean, Andreas Johnsson, you could say, I like the fact that he'll go to the front of the net and provide a screen. You know, you could say maybe you throw Nylander out there, but then you, from a talent standpoint, you really take a drop down to the second power play unit. And let's face it, I mean, it's pretty much a minute split.
Yeah,
the number one unit gets a minute to go to work, and then it's not nearly as dangerous when the second unit comes out. But I just think you've got so much talent on the ice. You've got to stick with that. I mean, you can talk strategies and everything else, but it's a pretty talented group out there that you're thinking, you know what, they should be able to figure it out. You saw those five guys out there. I think the difficult thing nowadays is, you know, you can have that power play going great early on in the season. And guess what? Every other team comes into your building and they sit and go through hours of power play film.
Yeah,
and they say, this is how we're going to react to it. So it's not like it was years ago when you say, I heard that Gretzky guy is pretty good. You know, we should keep an eye on him. And then, oh, that Curry guy is pretty good too. And Messier's not bad. But it's there's so much breakdown now on special teams, whether it's on the penalty kill or on the power play side of it, that teams know what you're doing. So even though you can get something that works for a while, well, once teams figure it out, and for me, because they don't have that big shot,
right,
the teams are just cluttering up the middle, and they want to take the seams away for the backdoor play and everything else. So I think that's where, like I said, if you get a little more movement, of course, in doing that, then you're vulnerable to one bad pass leads to a breakaway the other way because you've got everybody going towards the net and you've turned the puck over. But I just think if you get, you know, guys moving a little bit more instead of having that table hockey set up where everybody's in the same slot all the time and nobody, you know, is creative enough or confident enough to start moving things around. And I mean, I like to see Austin Matthews circle behind the net.
Yeah.
And go out the other side. You know, I think that's where you see some teams that are talented. You watch the Bruins. I mean, their skilled guys are all over the place. You know, they're not standing still. Everything's up, you know, almost like a ballet. People moving out of slots, and you know, you've still got the shot of pass to Nick, whether it's a one-timer at the top of the circle, or he'll slide down and try to do the tap-in play in a backdoor pass. So I think there's enough talent there that they should be able to figure it out. But I still believe without that big shot, you know, Ovechkin, Stamkos, whether it's Doughty or Burns or Carlson in San Jose, it's one element they don't have. So I think in some ways it's easier to try to shut down. Just collapse the box and get your sticks in the middle of the slot.
What explains the difficulty with the zone entries?
I'm not a huge fan on the four drop passes.
Okay.
Because basically what happens is you've got three guys standing on the blue line waiting. So somebody better carry it in or you're in trouble. You know, I think if you do that and you got three guys going, you can rifle it from center and, you know, go get it the old fashioned way. Outwork the opposition. But I've always had the one problem I've always had with it is that you've got too many guys standing still at the blue line waiting.
Mm-hmm.
And you've got no speed whatsoever coming in. And I know the mentality is that you get them backing off, but you see a lot of teams now to try to combat that method is everybody stands up in the blue line and saying, you're not going to shoot it in, so we're going to stand up and we're just going to disrupt it and get our sticks in the way.
Jim, you know, people take time when it comes to adjusting to a new team. There are obviously others who are just seamlessly fit in. It's, you know, you never know how it's going to go. Where do you see Tyson Barrie right now in terms of where his game was in Colorado and where he obviously hopes his game will be in Toronto?
No, I think this is where it gets tough when you cover one team all the time, Richard, is that the highlights I saw of Tyson Barrie were spectacular in Colorado. But, you know, you weren't watching him, you know, 22, 23 minutes a game. I think part of the tough part is he was the guy in the back end in Colorado. He's a very similar guy in Morgan Riley here. So I think it's, you know, you want to be the guy. And then number one, if you're not going to get the number one power play time, that's sort of taking the back seat to what you had, you know, and what you were used to and the responsibilities that came with it in Colorado. So I think even that part is an adjustment that not that you have a lesser role, but you're not considered the guy that we're going to get out there on the first power play unit. I still think there's that adjustment period that he's got to go through. I think that you talk to anybody, you know, just not so much dealing with the media, but how constant it is and how he's probably been talked about more in Toronto in 2 months than he was in Colorado in his career.
Mm. Right.
So it's, I think for a lot of players, that's huge. And I still laugh. I was laughing with my son about this, that, you know, visiting teams come in and Drew Doughty, what do you think of the Leafs? And Alex Ovechkin, what do you think of the Leafs? John Tortorella early on in the season said, I'm not here to talk about the Leafs. I'm here to talk about my team. That's kind of like the, you know, forget about me. What do you think of me? You know, it's that. So, I mean, it's a different animal here. And I think it's exciting for players to have, you know, people care on a daily basis about what they do. But I think for some, there's that adjustment that you can't have a bad game or a bad shift without having, you know, social media blow up and phoning shows and everything else be peppered with what's wrong with Tyson Barrie last night. You know, he was minus one.
Right. What Zach Hyman is due back or on the verge of coming back, what do you expect to see as a resulting move, Jim, when he gets back?
Oh, that's... you know, you feel bad for Jason Spezza if it's his number that's going to come up. You know, because I thought the game in Philly was his best game. I thought, you know, as the responsibility increased for Spezza, that he was better.
Right.
And so it'll be interesting to see how it plays out. But, yeah, you're going to have to do some shuffling. You know, Trevor Moore has been playing with Tavares and Mitch Marner in the last couple of games and has looked good. But Hyman obviously is going to slide right back in there and gives him that different element. But it's, I guess right now it's a nice problem to have, but you know, the way the league works too, You could have some injury happen tomorrow night against Philadelphia, and we're not even talking about it. We're talking about how great it is to have depth.
Yeah, I was going to say, what an asset he is to the team. Jimmy, thanks for doing this, man.
All right. Appreciate it. Thanks, Jeff. Thanks.
Take care. All righty. Jim Ralph, our Leafs radio analyst on Sportsnet 590 The Fan. We will have the Leafs and Blackhawks on Sportsnet 590 The Fan Sunday. That'll be part of our Rogers hometown hockey presentation. It'll be in Welland, Ontario, on Sportsnet Ontario. Puck drop will be just after 7. Hockey Night in Canada tomorrow night, the Leafs and the Flyers, and CBC and Sportsnet Ontario. Hockey Central Saturday, 6:30 p.m. on CBC. Puck drop will be just after 7. Leafs Nation postgame with El Berga and Stellick right after the final horn on Sportsnet 590 The Fan. There will also be a Leafs Nation pregame with El Berga and Stellick before Sunday's game against my Blackhawks, and a Leafs Nation postgame once it's done, as the boys will discuss the Blackhawks 4-2 win over the Toronto Maple
Leafs. Calling it. Call your shot there.
Not a chance in hell. But anyhow, we appreciate Jim joining us. An interesting take from Jim on the power play, and something I think that, you know, we had Tim Turk on earlier this week talking about the slap shot.
Yeah.
And it's one of the things you do notice, especially when the Leafs play teams that are bigger than them, and a lot of the teams they played have been bigger than them. But you essentially watched L.A. to a certain degree, but Vegas certainly last night. And really what they did was they just attempted to take away the middle. And there was a great sequence. There was a great sequence. And I listened to the game, and Jim and Joe had the call of the game. And I think it was Braden McNabb. No, that was the goal. He broke his stick. There was an earlier sequence where essentially a stick was broken. They left it. It stayed on the ice in the middle of the slot for basically like 5 minutes. But it was interesting. It was when the Leafs were on the power play, and one of the Knights players just kicks the stick into the middle. Mm. So it's in the slot.
High hockey IQ.
Well, it was funny because I'm watching it, and the final play of the second period is the puck gets sent down the ice, and for some reason the linesman hadn't picked up the stick. You know, there's two linesmen and a couple of officials. They hadn't picked up the stick, but the final play of the period, puck rolls down the ice and just rests, hits the stick. And I thought it was kind of funny, but just an example again of how teams are just really, really packing the middle.
I love Jimmy's point about like not having a traditional guy at the point, Jeff, who could sort of really, blast some shots. I think of like Carlson on the Capitals. He just opens up the play in front of the net with a rebound and blocking people's vision. I did think Tyson Barrie was going to be that guy.
Well, it's funny because...
hasn't happened yet.
No, the Leafs had a power play in that Washington game. We talked about it. They called the timeout, and they had Tyson Barrie and Morgan Rielly back on the blue line. And the play was clearly to set up Tyson Barrie for shot. And, of course, fired it over the net. But I don't know. I mean, I made notes of that game. I've been at the last couple of games. I don't know if I saw Tyson Barrie and Morgan Rielly on the ice together again after it. And I get it. And Jim's right. You know, part of the power play thing is if you look at this team, this power play unit, other than Andreas Janssen, you're talking about the best players in the team for the most part. So who are you going to take off, or who are you going to put on that's better than Austin Matthews? Who are you going to put on that you'd rather have the puck on their stick than John Tavares, Austin Matthews, Mitch Marner, and Morgan Rielly? You're just not.
Yeah.
You're not. So you have to figure out how to make what you have work. And to me, the only guy in that power play unit you could look at and say, okay, is disposable in terms of power play would be Janssen. But he does some stuff for you
that nobody else
does. I think Jim hit the nail on the head. The onus in this power play is on Austin Matthews. It's great to talk about setting him up for a shot and all that. You need to see Austin Matthews do more with the puck. Go behind the net and try to come out, create more movement. He, to me, is the one guy with the skills down in close, the skill and size, where he could do some things like that and open things up. Yeah. But
the numbers should go up because Tavares is back. We'll see. I mean, but if they don't, then you got a real issue. But you know, I'd like to see the sample size with him in the lineup for the next 5 to 10 games. But it's, you know, given how the team was constructed, Jeff, if, you know, we've said this now a million times, like that has to be one of the best units in the league.
It has to be. It absolutely has to be. Grant Wall is Sports Illustrated's national soccer writer. He's host of the Planet Football podcast. He's the author of Masters of Modern Soccer and the Beckham Experiment. Grant Wall joins Richard Deitch and myself ahead of the MLS Cup, which is Sunday. Toronto FC taking on the Seattle Sounders. It's Writer's Block with Blair and Deitch on Sportsnet 590 The Fan and Sportsnet 360.
Oddshark.net is your source for the latest odds from leading authorities, expert editorial content, and detailed matchup picks. Looking for statistics and trends from an upcoming game? Oddshark.net has that too, and it's free.
It's free.
Expert in-depth analysis, stats, numbers, and trends to help you make the sharp game day picks.
Whether you want to get in on the football action,
tonight's baseball game, or anything in between, head over to Oddshark.net and start playing like a shark today. This is not a gambling site.
Now, more Writer's Block on Sportsnet 590 The Fan.
Because she looks like a total prostitute, okay? I mean, her butt is just so big. I can't believe it's just so round. It's like out there. I mean, gross. Look, she's just so black.
I like big butts.
Welcome back to Writer's Block. Jeff Blair and Richard Deitch. Yeah, this video we're not showing on TV. What do you think of Brandeo's guilty pleasure so far?
Baby Got Back.
Baby Got Back.
This is a good selection.
So far, we've got...
I saw in the newsroom he was setting this up, so I knew this was coming.
Baby Got Back. We have Cher. Anyhow. Dead or Alive. Although you should have played the sweet version of that song. Anyhow, it is Writer's Block with Blair and Brent. Enough music chat. Toronto FC takes on the Seattle Sounders. I was going to say it's the third annual Seattle Sounders Toronto FC championship meeting.
Not really.
Interruption in between, but it'll be the third time the teams have met. And the rubber match, if you want to call it that. Of the MLS Cup meetings between these teams. Still no indication as to whether or not, well, formal indication as to whether or not Jozy Altidore will play. Look, it's the championship final, frankly, at this stage. Anything anybody says or suggests, regardless of their position, is BS. We won't know. We won't know until we either see him in street clothes or see him on the bench. Or see him in the lineup. We really won't know, I don't think, whether or not Jozy Altidore is ready to go. There is a game on November 15th of some significance. That is the U.S. and Canada. The return match in Orlando, the CONCACAF Nations League. I don't know how that figures into what Jozy Altidore wants to do or how that would impact the MLS Cup. I've got to think. I have to think if you're Jozy Altidore, the MLS Cup takes precedence over that. But I like Toronto FC's chances. They've been on a roll. They seem to have solved some of the defensive issues that have kind of been chronic with this team for a while. There's certainly more depth than I think we anticipated, particularly attacking depth. Greg Vanney has more options than he's had in the past. I this is a team that has done well on the road as well.
Keepers in a rhythm. There's a lot of check marks for them.
There really is. Grant Wall is SI's national soccer writer. He's host of the Planet Football podcast, author of Masters of Modern Soccer and the Beckham Experiment. Grant Wall joins Richard Deitch and myself on Writer's Block. Grant, thank you so much for joining us.
Yeah, today. How are you guys?
We're doing well. If I asked you to pick one thing from each team that has to happen for them to have a shot, you know, to have a shot at winning this, what would it be? We could start with Seattle if you want.
Yeah, Seattle, I think they need to have Nicholas Lodero play like the player he has been in the postseason, which is a difference maker. He's the captain for their team. He's their number 10. He was absolutely terrific in their upset of LAFC in the semifinal. And you can make the argument that Lodero, over the past, you know, since joining the league in 2016, has been the league's best player overall over that period. So I see no reason why he can't do that again in this game, though I was impressed with how Toronto defended against Atlanta in the last game and shut down their best attackers. In terms of Toronto, you know, they've been very impressive on the road. I still feel like Pozuelo can make an even bigger impact potentially on the playoffs. He had a good game in New York in that win. You know, I think for Toronto to get this win, that he has to really have a big game, and I think he's capable of it. He's a terrific player.
Grant, it's been 19 months since we sat next to each other in New York. I'm
that long?
Yeah. I your career is still continuing, so I'm very happy to see that, Grant. one of the things in terms of Toronto FC that we've certainly asked every guest that has come on the show is what they think changed with this group and why they have been a entirely different group from June on. From your perspective, what's different about Toronto FC, or what has been different about them in the second half versus the first half?
Well, they had to deal with some real personnel changes with important players in the first half of the season. You know, Jovinko left, Victor Vasquez, and, you know, Pozuelo eventually comes in. And so I think that took a while to get things going. And for a while, we were wondering if they would even qualify for the playoffs. But I had an interesting conversation with Quentin Westberg this week, the goalkeeper. Wrote a story about it on SI.com that came out yesterday. And, you know, this is his first season with this team, so he wasn't around for the previous playoff runs. But he told me that as far as the playoffs were concerned, he kept hearing about their experience of success in the playoffs and the postseason and how things really dialed up, you know, on that team during the playoffs. And he was like, in the first playoff game in Toronto against DC United, I saw it, that the intensity went up, that this team has a playoff mode that not every MLS team has, even MLS teams that finished ahead of Toronto during the regular season. So if he's sensing that, and he's a guy who is noticing a lot of things going on in his team, I thought that was an interesting insight and tells you a lot about this Toronto team and why they're here in the final again.
We had him on. He's a fascinating guy, isn't he, Quentin Westberg?
He really is. French-American, but he's playing just his first season in Toronto, in MLS. You know, he was on, I first started covering him at the 2003 Under-17 World Cup, where that was Freddie Adu's U.S. debut at a youth level, when Freddie Adu was the hottest prospect in global soccer.
Right.
And I actually went to Finland to cover that because I was thinking of writing a book about Freddie Adu. And I, you know, never would have suspected in 2003 that 16 years later, the only player from that U.S. team, and there were several other good players too, like Jonathan Spector and Eddie Gavin and others, Westberg is the only one of them playing today in a first division professional league. And it's a sad story, obviously, about Freddie Adu, but Westberg's story has been very steady, had you know, a successful career in France. He played in all three divisions, first, second, and third over there. He's well known because he was part of a documentary that was very popular on Canal Plus over in France, following him at the Clairefontaine Academy. So just a fascinating guy, and he's seen a lot.
Grant, you know, one of the things that has been particularly striking for MLS has been this playoff, this postseason. Really exciting games. They've been rewarded by increased viewership in the States in terms of what they've been getting on ESPN, Fox, et cetera. And now we have the championship game. It's a pretty broad question, but Where do you think MLS is at the moment in the sort of the public consciousness, and particularly after what's been a pretty good postseason, I think?
Yeah, you know, I think TV ratings are the area where MLS has actually struggled over a long time to make an impact, but the ratings are up during this postseason. They had a new format this time with their all single elimination games, and there's no rest during the FIFA window for 2 weeks, which used to be a real problem for cutting down momentum in the playoffs. And so I think the format change has been really good, and it rewards teams more for performing well during the regular season. You get home games during the playoffs. So, you know, I think that part's been good. They got really good ratings for that LA Galaxy, LAFC game in the playoffs, you know, around an audience of 1 million, which for MLS is unheard of. So, you know, I think that's all good. I mean, on the business side, this league is doing well. It's expanding. There's 29 teams now that are committed, and we're hearing that Charlotte potentially could be announced before too long as a 30th. They're paying expansion fees of $200 million. The next one will be $300 million. They're building soccer stadiums. So there's certainly a lot of competition to get involved in MLS from some very wealthy people, but they still have a ways to go in terms of really getting the television ratings that could make it a league that really would compete with the top European leagues, because right now MLS still has a salary cap and can't compete to buy the world's top players in their prime yet.
The other thing is there are CBA negotiations going on, which I admit I wasn't aware of until I did some reading and some digging on them. But we, you know, those of us who have lived through NHL lockouts and baseball strikes tend to get our backs up when we hear about a CBA. Is there any concern at all about where this league is in terms of labor?
I mean, it's going to be a concern until the next season starts and there's an agreement. You know, the players' union had a teleconference yesterday, and they sound very willing to have a work stoppage if they don't get the deal they want. They see the money that's being paid to start an expansion team in MLS. They want that to go to salaries. They want to get more in terms of free agency, which they have kind of a slight bit of, but not a lot, that they got in the last CBA agreement. And the big question always will be, do they have the, you know, will they really follow that up? Would they really go on strike? And we haven't seen MLS players do that before. So that's my biggest question here, but it sounds like they're, you know, better organized, more resolute than in the past, and we'll see how things shake out in January.
Grant, the Canadian men's national team is going to face the U.S. pretty soon. We saw the result up here, obviously a glorious result for Canada, a catastrophic result for the U.S. and Taylor Twellman and Ian Dark. It's actually fun to watch, just totally went off on the U.S. national team. Where you've covered this team basically for as long as I've known you. Where is this team right now, and why are they in this position?
Well, it's just a funk of giant proportions that includes failing to qualify for the 2018 World Cup, which is literally the biggest failure in the history of U.S. soccer. And they hired Greg Berhalter, but it was a ridiculously long process to hire him. He didn't take over until December of 2018, when he could have done it probably a year earlier. And that's the Federation's fault. And, you know, that loss to Canada for the U.S., first time the U.S. lost to Canada in 35 years. And beyond that, the U.S. looked bad. Give Canada credit. They've got some very good young players, and they finally seem to be becoming, you know, a team that's better than the sum of their parts. And it's always kind of been the opposite in the past with Canada. But there's some real problems on this U.S. team. And so now what's fascinating to me is you have Greg Berhalter coming out publicly and saying this is a must-win game against Canada, and sort of implying that, you know, if that doesn't happen, that maybe he should go, that they're acknowledging that. And that certainly raises the stakes from what I expected we would see with, you know, what typically would be sort of a ho-hum U.S.-Canada Nations League game. Now the stakes are pretty high.
Grant, it was great of you to do this. Thanks so much, as always.
Enjoyed it, guys. Take care.
See you, Grant.
Grant Wall of SI, author of the Beckham Experiment, Masters of Modern Soccer, host of the Planet Football podcast, and of course the national soccer writer for SI. And it's next Friday, Canada plays.
Can you believe that?
15th.
Could you have ever imagined an American journalist saying this is a must win for the United States or they may lose their coach? That's incredible. But he's right. Like, that is where that program is. And if Canada could win that game or draw, as we were talking about, Jeff, it really does set them up for a real shot at the World Cup.
Well, I think it really, what it also does is, if you're John Herdman, you know, you are prepared for people to start asking questions again if you don't beat the Americans. Okay, you beat them in Canada. That's great. First time in 35 years, but was anything really accomplished? That's kind of where we are right now with soccer, with Canadian soccer fans. But a draw or a win against the Americans, and, you know, you start to see the interest that a lot of us think is out there manifest itself in terms of attendance and in terms of the desire to see Canada's team play and the desire to see it advance.
Yeah.
I think, you know, I thought that the last game was the biggest game, the most important game Canadian men's soccer team has played in a long time because of what was at stake after the Gold Cup, after losing to Haiti and all that. And in a lot of ways, and I'm not a big fan of saying that this is the second annual biggest game ever, but I think if Canada doesn't at least draw this game, it's not that it's a step back, because you can't take away from the fact that you beat the Americans and you outplayed them. You played them off the pitch, frankly. That, no one can take that away from Canada, but it looks a little less dramatic if you don't beat the Americans. And if you do beat the Americans in Orlando, then, as I said, you're talking the men's team going where it hasn't gone for 25 or 30 yeah. years.
Really exciting. Yeah. I'll be very, very fascinated, Jeff, the first 20, 15 minutes of that game.
A reminder, by the way, your team could be playing in a game called by Joe Bone and Jim Ralph live on Sportsnet 590 The Fan. We are talking about the first annual Champions of Rec League Cup, brought to you by the Beer Store. Be sure to submit your votes for the remaining teams at sportsnet.ca/CORL. This contest is open to Ontario residents only. It's Writer's Block with Blair and Deitch. We'll be back on Sportsnet 590 The Fan and 360.
Now, more Writer's Block on Sportsnet 590 The Fan.
Now you're reaching, Brandeo. Anyhow, we'll send out Derek Brandeo's guilty pleasures list, along with the rest of our guilty pleasures list, which have already been sent out. I think Jen's still...
She's the leader.
She's the leader. The Spice Girls just kind of put it over the top. I tried to counter that with One Direction, but it's not the same. It's not the same. I thought Robbie Williams gave me... I thought I was in with a shout with Robbie Williams, but... I don't know. I thought maybe I needed a different closer than One Direction. You think that's it? I should have closed it out. Maybe I should have closed it out with Robbie Williams instead of closing it out with One Direction.
It was going to be tough to beat Jen's list regardless.
Yeah. Anyhow, let's just declare Jen Rolnick the winner of our Guilty Pleasures competition. We'll come up with something for next week.
I like it.
Songs about days or something. Maybe we'll ask listeners to send in their guilty pleasures and put together a list.
We could do that.
So we'll do that. I'll tweet that out on Monday, because I'm not going to go anywhere near Twitter the second that I get off this thing. Believe me. So I'll tweet that out on Monday, maybe, and we'll let you submit your selections for your guilty pleasures list. The LA Raiders. This is weird. Last night, the Raiders beat the Chargers 26-24. A couple of things. First of all, as someone who can actually remember watching AFL games in the tube, that was cool. Oakland. Oakland wearing the silvery letters.
Yeah.
The Chargers, even though they're in L.A., that was kind of cool. I mean, I was thinking Lance Allworth was going to come out, or John Hadle with Remember John Hadle with the one bar, the single bar face? Anyhow, I was expecting all that stuff to happen.
I like the Fouts, Jefferson, Joyner Chargers. Those are my favorite Chargers.
Ken Stabler. Anyhow, it was odd, though. You know, I covered the Expos in their final year in Montreal, and that was a death march. I mean, every day you woke up and you said, okay, that was there are now 19 home games left. There's now 18 home games left. We've got two home series left. The Raiders are going to Vegas. That was the last primetime game Oakland's going to play in. I didn't see a lot of tears. People seemed to be having fun. Now, I don't know if this is, Richard, we've still got essentially half a season to play. The Raiders are actually, they're kind of they're positioned right now to make the playoffs.
Yeah, 5-4, they have a real shot.
And, you know, maybe fans have just decided, first of all, they're football fans, so maybe they're all so drunk that they don't realize what's going on. But it seems to me that the Raiders fans have just decided, you know what, we're going to ride this out. We're going to have fun. I watched part of the game and you didn't even get the sense it was a resigned crowd. You didn't. The crowd was in it. Well, and I'm comparing that to Montreal. I mean, that was just sadness. That was abject sadness as that thing wound down.
Yeah, so there's a couple things there, Jeff. One, they won, so that always helps. So there's a celebratory mood. I like the fact that Gruden and some other members of the Raiders organization went to the Black Hole group.
Yeah,
and
that
sort
was
of hugged
cool.
them. That's kind of cool. And I think you've sort of hit it. The fact that there's a lot of the season left, I think the last home game there, I'd be really curious to see what the mood is.
I think they'll rip up the stadium, take the chairs and throw them in the...
That's a good question.
But, because it's a Raider crowd. Yeah, they're lunatics, but...
Yeah, the one thing, I feel like that whole issue has been going on, it feels like, for like 20 years, right. There's finally a resolution. They're moving to Vegas. I feel like the crowd is... and somewhat accepted their fate. But sort of in terms of this season, like that was a very important win in the season. Like that put them at 5-4. They have a real wild card shot now. And I think people were just excited about the fact that they sort of have turned the season around.
And, you know, Raiders Nation travels. Travis, could you take a quick look and find out how far Vegas is from Oakland? Because I'm willing to bet that Southwest or somebody, I know they fly there. I'm willing to bet that there will be a lot of people. Well, a lot of people going from Oakland to
Well, when next time Amy Trask's on, we'll ask her. But I guess the question will be, will it be a St. Louis situation where the people have no interest in being connected to the Rams? Or will it be, like you said, we're going to continue to support the team? Vegas is only, whatever, 2.5-hour drive or an hour flight.
Because the Raiders kind of like the Cowboys. They're kind of a brand. They're like the Packers.
Definitely.
They're a brand, right?
Oh, yeah. I consider them a national team.
And you can embrace what it means to be a Raiders fan without having to be in Oakland. And maybe that explains part of it as well.
Yeah, I have no great feel for whether the NFL in Las Vegas will be a surefire hit. It seems logically it would be given all the money that's there, and given that it seems like it would be a fun thing for people to do if they happen to be in Vegas that weekend, we'll see.
Yeah.
You do want some kind of home crowd advantage, though. You know, you don't just want transients in the crowd.
A weekend in Vegas. Travis, fill me in.
It is about an 8.5-hour drive, but a 1 hour, 20-minute flight.
There you go. 1 hour, 20 minutes in Southwest. That's not even a bag of peanuts.
Yeah, that's all right. That's doable.
Not even a bag of peanuts in Southwest. So there you go. Thank you, Travis. There you go.
Yeah.
Maybe they're counting on that. Dan Wojcicki is a national basketball writer with the L.A. Times. The Raptors have got back-to-back games against the Clippers and the Lakers coming up. We'll talk to Dan. Talk some hoops. It's Writer's Block on 590 and 360.
They're not afraid to put their name on it. This is Writer's Block with Jeff Blair and Richard Deitch on Sportsnet 590 The Fan.
The Toronto Raptors are opening their... so far, their longest road trip of the year. I don't know if there's one actually longer. They play five games starting tonight in New Orleans against the Pelicans. Then it's on to Portland to play the Trail Blazers. Back-to-back in L.A. against the Clippers and Lakers before wrapping up a week ago from today in Dallas against the Dallas Mavericks. Of course, the back-to-backs in L.A. are going to be rife with storylines. Anytime you play the Lakers, it's a big storyline for anybody. There is the added aspect of Danny Green with the Lakers. And, of course, the Clippers and Raptors game will be the first time the teams have met since Kawhi Leonard left the Raptors for the Clippers. And I think it's kind of interesting, Richard, that as the Raptors get in town, I mean, they'll be, I wouldn't say they'll be landing in the middle of a storm of controversy around Kawhi Leonard and load management, because that storm will probably have passed. But certainly, I guarantee you that at some point, the question is going to be asked of Kawhi or asked of the Raptors by somebody. Can you guys revisit the whole load management situation and how it was handled in Toronto last year? Mm. And so it's not going away. It's not going away, is what I'm saying. Dan Wojcicki is a national basketball writer with the LA Times. He joins Richard Deitch and myself in Writer's Block. Dan, thank you so much for joining us today. Well, before we talk about the Raptors versus Clippers, Raptors versus Lakers, I do want to touch a bit on the fine the Clippers got as a result of this, the hassle that was created by load management. And Richard and I are both of the idea. I'd be interested in knowing what you think of this. We're both of the idea that this, you know, the fine aside, the fine and the fact that the NBA has let the world know what is wrong now with Kawhi Leonard in terms of health, it almost seems as if it's a shot across the bow by Adam Silver for other teams that may be contemplating load management. In other words, if you guys are going to pull this off, you better have a better understanding of nuance, and you better make sure that everybody's on the same page when it comes to explaining it to the public.
Well, and I think, you know, the real reason, you know, the reason why the Clippers were fined, right, is because they were telling people that Kawhi Leonard was healthy,
mm-hmm.
even though, I mean, that's why the fine was there, right? Doc Rivers, you know, intimated it, said it, you know, he said a lot of things, but he did say that Kawhi feels great, you know, that this isn't a health thing. These were some of the things he kind of said. And privately, you know, there were people within the organization saying that, you know, he's healthy and this is just part of what we're doing to keep him fresh, you know, and they were wrong. Those people are wrong. And I think weirdly, in addition to kind of, you know, sending a message to everyone else, I think the league inadvertently, in some ways, did the Clippers a favor. They don't have to do that anymore. They don't have to lie. They don't have to talk around it. They don't have to protect Kawhi Leonard's privacy because we all know now. You know, like it is.
I guess my point, though, too, is I'm not a big fan of the league saying, "Oh, this is the injury." By the way, in case you're all wondering.
Yeah, well, this is like, and that's what's so interesting, I think, about all of this, right? Is sort of like, you know, why did they do this? Why do they feel like they have to do this? I think, you know, a big thing, obviously, right? We look at, you know, who the league partners with. You know, it feels like every 2 weeks, guys, I hear, you know, whether it's a daily fantasy game or a casino or something like that. The NBA is very committed to moving forward with sports betting. As a way to continue the growth of the game, as a way to keep people interested as television ratings decline and stuff like that. And it's hard to have people betting on games if you're not being super transparent about injuries. Mm. You know, the NFL, for all of its flaws and people manipulate it and stuff like that. But, you know, you get 5 days worth of an injury report, you know, where people's participation is far more detailed than it is in basketball, where there's no real formal system. At least they used to not even be one at all. And you know, they've kind of gradually moved towards this direction. So I think by pointing a finger at this, and they're saying like, you know, you have to be specific about it. Now, did the NBA ever want to do that per se? No, I mean, I think they'd hope the Clippers would have done it a little more subtly, you know, but it was clear that they weren't handling the nuance of it well. Now, this being said, I think weirdly this probably helps the Clippers with Kawhi Leonard in some ways too, guys, because, you know, the motivation for this, at least as far as I can gather from people, is that Kawhi Leonard didn't want people talking about it. This is something that, I mean, if we know anything about Kawhi Leonard, right, is that he enjoys having people not know a lot about Kawhi Leonard.
Mm-hmm.
And by doing this and by being out in front of it, by trying to protect him and keep, you know, his health status as private as possible, I think maybe, you know, in a new relationship, it helps, you know, kind of grow some trust. It's a really interesting situation in a lot of ways. I can't remember ever seeing a fine quite like this that was certainly worded this way. It is weird that the NBA is detailing an injury, but that's where the league's at right now. They think that's an important part of what they need to do is they need to be transparent about players' health. And that might mean when you've got a player like Kawhi Leonard that you kind of out a problem that hadn't previously really been detailed, at least not to that level.
Dan, both the Lakers and the Clippers were teams that were drawing interest far away from Los Angeles this year. Based on expectations, understanding it's early, but based on expectations, where do you think the Lakers are and where do you think the Clippers are against where we thought they might be right now?
I feel like I had a conversation today with an executive, and the way I put it to him was sort of like the Lakers are like having a $100 bill in your pocket right now. Like, it's, you know what it's worth and you feel good about it. And the Clippers are having like maybe like $100 worth of stock. We don't really quite know what that is yet. I mean, with Kawhi Leonard, they've been terrific. Without him, they're winless. We haven't seen Paul George. We don't know what that's going to look like. I think people feel pretty good about the health of his shoulders, but we don't know. Whereas with the Lakers, we've seen just how good Anthony Davis and LeBron James can be together, just how good that can make the role players around them. We've seen, you know, more shooting, better defense from guys. I think certainly after that first game when the two teams played, which was like quite an event in Los Angeles, there was a lot of sense that, boy, the Lakers have a lot of work to do, and, boy, the Clippers are going to be scary. And I still think people feel that way about the Clippers. As far as the Lakers, though, I think it's a closer towards, like, finished isn't the right word because you don't want to peak in November. But I think we know what they can be, and I think they've cemented their place as being a real contender this season. And, you know, they played a really good basketball. I think a good start has been so important to them for so many different reasons. We haven't heard about Jason Kidd and Frank Vogel. We haven't heard about, you know, problems with the way Anthony Davis and LeBron James have closed games. We haven't heard about rotations or any of this stuff. It's just been about winning. And I think it's allowed a new group to kind of settle in with one another.
I mean, all you have to do now is ensure that Anthony Davis doesn't go off on those sort of, you know, Chicago's the basketball mecca, those verbal wanderings that he's sometimes
yeah,
known to do, and they can probably manage the situation. Hey, I'm intrigued in how Anthony Davis has adapted to being a Clipper. Has he changed at all in the time he's gone there? Is he a little more media savvy? Have you noticed anything different about how he relates to people since he's gone there?
Are we talking AD with the Lakers?
Yeah,
Or Kawhi with the Clippers?
No, I'm talking about AD.
Okay, with
about
the
AD. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I think, look, I think him and LeBron have a nice sort of yin yang on this stuff, and I think, you know, post game you see it, they alternate, right? Their lockers are right next to each other, and they kind of decide beforehand who's going to talk, who's going to shower. One of them talks, the other guy goes and does his thing, and then the other guy comes back and talks. You know, there's been a balance with that. I think being in a big spotlight, people don't say bad things about Anthony Davis necessarily, as like a person. Like, I've, like, you know, he's not difficult per se or anything like that. I think, you know, as any of these situations from a media standpoint, like, you know, I'm sure that I know the media wish they spoke to him more. You know what I mean? I think, and when you put it up against someone like LeBron James, who speaks all the time, like that always is a thing. But, you know, as far as a change, you know, from New Orleans, I mean, I still think people feel the same way about him as a person. You know, that was what was so interesting, I think, about his trade demand last year, was that this was like, you know, a guy who had been sort of a good silent soldier for so many years in New Orleans. And to see him go to clutch, to see some of these things verbalized, you know, people looked at Anthony Davis a little differently and saw a guy who was taking more of his career in play. But you know, it's a fascinating thing. We haven't seen a huge change yet, but we also haven't seen any real problems yet. I think chaos and stuff like that, that'll show, mm-hmm. you know, when you've only lost once, things have been pretty smooth sailing.
Yep.
Dan, two for me. You can take either one when you want. First one is the Raptors playing Kawhi Leonard is going to be a massive story here for obvious reasons. I'm curious, though, how is that playing in Los Angeles, if it even is playing in Los Angeles? And then the second thing is, you know, interestingly enough, Dan, the LeBron and China comments now feels like a lifetime ago. And I think there were probably some of us who thought this was going to linger all year. Hasn't necessarily been the case.
No, I mean, I think the answer to both of these things is that, you know, and sometimes the media is kind of like a kitten with a shiny ball in front of it, you know, where we're easy to distract. And as far as Kawhi in Toronto, like, we really haven't gotten there yet. You know, load management has sort of been the story du jour in Los Angeles as the city tries to wrap its head around what it is and you know, seeing a superstar player not on the court every night. You know, this is a city where, you know, you look at a guy like Kobe Bryant, right, who's deified for stepping on the court and making two free throws with a ruptured Achilles tendon. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? Like, it does sort of embrace that type of stuff. So I think there's a getting used to phase, certainly with, you know, seeing a marquee game like the Bucks and the Clippers and not seeing Kawhi Leonard on the floor. So I think that's been like sort of the big thing. And as far as the Lakers and LeBron, you know, I think he kind of nipped it in the bud by saying, like, I'm talking about this one more time and then that's it. And it just hasn't, it just kind of went away. And I think that, you know, the league had hoped that this would happen, that the games would take on a life of their own. And again, I think maybe if the Lakers had gotten off to, say, a 1-6 start, you know what I mean? Maybe we'd be talking more about the distraction of China and how China has put, you know, such a cloud over this season and over this team. But I think because they've been winning, because they've been rolling, you know, and the other stories are all just so obvious. I mean, this Dwight Howard is a fan favorite in Los Angeles again, which is just like a sign of the apocalypse.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's all this craziness that I think, you know, people have just kind of moved on it, and neither is really sort of specifically the LeBron and China, but we haven't spent a lot of time talking about the Raptors per se either, outside of sort of load management. Obviously, that'll change this week, but. It's interesting, just I think, because both teams are so good and the city hasn't had both teams be so good at the same time. Really, the on-court product has been sort of the driver of conversation and narrative. Mm.
Joined by Dan Wojcik, he's a national basketball writer with the LA Times. We know that part of getting Kawhi was to sort of establish or reestablish or give the Clippers as well a bit of a foothold in terms of branding in LA. You know, we've seen the alternate jerseys, which are great and all that. But I'm wondering, is there a difference, Dan, between a Lakers fan and a Clippers fan? You know, is there a geographical difference from a different part of LA? Are there, you know, I don't know, socioeconomic differences, ethnic differences? How would you compare the Clippers fan to the Lakers fan, or can you?
Well, I think a Clippers fan is a little crazier. Mm-hmm. You know, you've had to see some stuff and experience some stuff that just hasn't been the same. You know, for Laker fans, I think, you know, there was, I think, a time where it was sort of like a lot of people who were Clippers fans were transplants who couldn't afford Laker tickets, who loved basketball and were just sort of looking for a team. You know, the way they're pitching this is certainly that that Lakers fandom is about glam and it's about celebrity and you know, spotlights, and like the Clippers, they're a blacktop team, and, and they're a grinded out kind of group. That's been the marketing in the city. Is it true? I'm not really. You know, I think like you go up into the upper deck at Staples Center during the Lakers games, and you're going to find a lot of hardworking people, a lot of people who aren't, you know, in the movies or in the business. Like it's going to, these are going to be, you know, blue collar, blacktop people.
Right.
You know, like you'll see that, and they'll be from all like the city. They're all different races, all different parts of town. Like tickets are expensive. They're expensive for both teams. You know, it's actually weirdly, you know, get in for Clippers games has been actually not too bad lately on the secondary market. You know, you can walk in the door for less than $20 in the upper deck most nights, which has been a little bit of a surprise. But that's definitely been the way they've been pushing this, right? And I think the Clippers play in Los Angeles is a long-term one. They spent a lot of money, you know, putting their jerseys on the backs of kids in youth leagues and refurbishing parks around the city, and doing things like that to try to build a new generation of Clipper fans. Obviously winning is going to do a lot with that. And for people who are new to the city over the last decade, it's mostly been the Clippers winning. But it's still, it's one of the most bizarre things that I've ever experienced in sports journalism is that when you cover the Clippers, and I did this for six seasons, it's a bigger deal to cover the Clippers in Toronto, in New York, in Boston than it is to cover the Clippers in Los Angeles. Like they are a bigger national story than they are a local story. And it's hard to think of another team that's quite like that.
That's interesting.
It's really bizarre. And it's, you know, some of it is obviously the Clippers have had some really big historic missteps organizationally through the years. But, you know, another big part of it is this, that Lakers shadow is so long and it's so dark in there that it's hard. It's hard to keep up. And you know, a good Lakers team will always kind of, at least in Q rating in the city right now, outrank a good Clippers team. We'll see what happens when Paul George gets on the court. We'll see if the Clippers start mowing through teams and you know, really take off and they dominate the city series against the Lakers. You know, we'll see. But you know, if the Clippers' goal was to win Los Angeles, I think it's a stupid goal. I think it's just something you can't do. And I think you can, the good news for them is it's a big enough city where you can still, where second place is still pretty lucrative.
Dan, obviously in this market, Kawhi Leonard did not talk a lot, although it was certainly sort of polite and anytime he did. I wonder if you have been able to get a sense yet from either him or Kawhi's camp, if he's happy with his decision. Like this is not to per se that he was coming back to Toronto, but you know, it was a little bit of a leap for him to go to the Clippers. And from what you've seen so far, does he like his teammates? Does he like the organization? Is he feeling comfortable with his surroundings?
Yeah. I mean, I think so far it's been a huge success on that front. Right. I think he enjoys being around family. I think he enjoys being around communities that, you know, helped kind of raise him. He's done a lot of, he's done some stuff. I wouldn't say a lot of stuff. You know, he donated tons of backpacks and school supplies, you know, in the school district that, you know, he came up through and that was meaningful to him. He wore a shirt last night designed by some of those students. You know, like that kind of for him, like qualifies as expressiveness in some ways, you know, like that type of stuff. You know, he's been polite with us when he's talked. I think the Clippers have empowered him to take care of his body and to do the things that he needs to do to feel as ready as possible. And that most nights means waiting 90 minutes or so for him to do his media after games, you know, which has been a frustration for reporters. But, I don't think Kawhi, it's not malicious. I think it's just, you know, he's in the situation where he's empowered to do that stuff. And I think, like I mentioned before, with what happened with Doc and the fine, I think the Clippers went to great lengths to get him. And I think they've shown that they're willing to go to great lengths to keep him happy. And I think if you're a star player where money would have been there no matter where you go, and those are the kinds of things that matters. The sense that I've always gotten Kawhi Leonard is this is a guy who does what he wants to do. And he's not somebody who seemingly has ever, like, he doesn't seem like he second guesses a lot. And so, you know, so far I think he seems pretty comfortable. I think it seems like, you know, he wanted to be in Los Angeles, and I think if he wanted to be a Laker, he would have ended up on in a Laker uniform. So I think he's where he wanted to be, and the team's playing pretty good basketball, and, you know, they're allowing him to kind of, you know, create and go through his own routine. So I don't think there's been a lot for him to be upset about yet.
Dan, thanks so much for joining us. Terrific insight.
All right, be good, guys.
Thanks, Take care.
Dan Wojcicki, he's a national basketball writer with the LA Times. You can follow him on Twitter at Dan Wojcicki Sports. It is interesting hearing him talk about Kawhi and comparing the Lakers and Clippers. And I think Dan makes an interesting point, because if you look at New York, the national story in New York in terms of baseball is the Yankees. Local story in New York in terms of baseball is the Yankees. Chicago, national story in terms of Chicago is the Cubs. Local story in Chicago is the Cubs. Mm. L.A., right? Local story in L.A. is the Dodgers. Local story or national story in L.A. in terms of baseball is the Dodgers. So in a lot of two-team markets, that's sort of where we're at. But that's not the case in L.A. because the Lakers are not a big national story. Let me correct. No, the Lakers are always a national story, but not to the degree that the Clippers are because of Kawhi.
Yeah, I just thought it was fascinating. He said that the Clippers are a bigger story in Toronto and Chicago than they are in Los Angeles. That's an interesting team to cover or be around if you're one of those reporters. Because I am fascinated by the Clippers, and I'm really interested in them. But as Dan is saying, it's a Laker town and remains a Laker town.
Yeah, it does tell you, and I do love his point as well. Look, if the idea behind all this is to turn LA into a Clippers town, it's not going to work.
Right.
It's just not going to work. You've got the weight of history. You got the weight of
everything.
Everything.
Yeah. I think their best marketing is going to be winning a championship.
I think their best marketing will be winning a championship. And let's see what the Lakers do post LeBron.
Right.
Because I'm still not sure AD's got the, I don't know if he's got the jam to be that transcendent guy the way LeBron has been. Maybe Giannis will end up there.
He could.
But you know what I'm saying, right?
Anthony Davis is
he's a great player.
Charismatic, great player, but he's not when you think of the league and the sort of the if somebody asks you when you think of the NBA, what's the first thing you think of? He's down the list.
Yes.
LeBron James?
Absolutely.
First on the list.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Without question. John Champion is ESPN's MLS play-by-play voice. He will have the call of the MLS Cup on Sunday between Toronto FC and the Seattle Sounders. John Champion will join Richard Deitch and myself. It's Writer's Block for a Friday on Sportsnet 590 The Fan and Sportsnet 360.
Now, more Writer's Block on Sportsnet 590 The Fan.
Hometown hockey is stopping in Welland this weekend, and Sportsnet 590 The Fan will be broadcasting live on location with George Russick and Brent Gunning on Saturday. You can find our promo team on site for your chance to win prizes like a signed John Tavares jersey or a custom voicemail message recorded for you by Ron McLean and Tara Sloan. Find out more details at sportsnet.ca/590. I like those recorded.
Famous people. I'd love to get a message from Ron McLean and Tara Sloan. That'd be cool.
Isn't there some sort of website or something where you can like pay money and famous people who are out of work?
I think
record?
There was.
Cameo?
I think they did.
Cameo? Is that what it's called?
Might have folded though. No, does it still exist? I think there was somebody had that idea and it might have went belly up. Apologies if it
Travis didn't. McKenzie, I know you want to say something witty. Weigh in here.
Cameo allows you to pay for personalized messages from celebrities of your choice.
Still exists, Travis?
Yeah, it's just picking up in popularity right now.
Okay, give me some of the celebrities. Just give me a for instance.
Antonio Brown did a famous one.
Famous. Okay, all right. Yeah. Yeah,
a lot of ex-pro wrestlers as well.
Yeah, well.
Oh, that's good. I like that.
That would be right up your alley.
I know.
Boy, I'd love that. I wouldn't know any of the current wrestlers, let alone the ex.
Love to get a voicemail from Sting. That'd be great.
From who?
Sting.
The singer?
Sting. No, not the singer. No, no, the wrestler. Steve Borden.
How come you know so much about wrestling?
I just find it fascinating. I find, like, the storylines and just how they produce this stuff fascinating. I also think that studying pro wrestling and kayfabe is the best insight into the current president of the United States, to be very honest. Because I think a lot of what is going on with Donald Trump is kayfabe, is professional wrestling. So it's twofold for me.
All right.
Yeah.
Okay. We'll have to have that discussion.
Yeah,
sometime.
It's a good one. We could get there. Renee Young was in studio. You liked her. You found her delightful.
Yeah, because she bought coffee. She bought fancy coffee.
People from that world are really interesting. I mean, pro wrestlers and the announcers, they're interesting people. They're like, they lead gypsy lives. They're putting on a performance every night. It's an interesting world. Or I should say, I find it interesting. Anyway.
I love Deitch's reaction when we're talking about a topic and I just kind of sit there quietly.
Well, it's hard to just go on if you're just being quiet.
But there are times I got nothing to say about the stuff you're talking about. Not personal. I got to say.
I like our next guest, though.
I do, too. We're going to bring him on. He is John Champion, MLS play-by-play voice on ESPN. John, thanks so much for joining Richard Deitch and myself. You will, of course, have the call of Sunday's MLS Cup between Toronto FC and the Seattle Sounders. What's the atmosphere like? I know this is a difficult question because in some ways we're comparing apples and oranges, John, but can you compare and contrast the atmosphere around a big football match overseas compared to an MLS match?
It's different in that the sport of football, or this code of football, if you're in one of the mainstream European countries that have embraced it for many, many years, it is to a large extent the nation's conversation. And even I, as an enthusiast for soccer stroke football, couldn't claim that it's the nation's conversation in either Canada or the United States. But I'm sitting actually at a picnic table at the moment outside Starfire Sports Center, which is the Seattle Sounders training hub. And Toronto FC are about to go through their paces. We're about to go and see them and meet with the head coach, Greg Vanney. And when we arrived here, there was a crowd perhaps 500 deep, largely decked out in Seattle colors, waiting for the Seattle players to train earlier this morning. When I got to the airport last night on my flight across the country from Boston, there were lots and lots of people getting off planes decked out in their Seattle colors, the rave green. So this is slightly unusual in that this is a city, Seattle, that, as we all know, is sports mad, but more specifically is soccer mad and has been for a significant period of time. Mm-hmm. This is 45 years of professional soccer in this city. So there is more of a feeling for the sport. And so I can actually relate the build-up to this MLS Cup final to the build-up, say, to an FA Cup final or a Champions League final back in Europe, except that it's not making ripples across the country in the way that it is making waves, certainly in Seattle at the moment.
John, please send our best to Taylor Twellman, who's been a guest on this show before. You've been carrying him all year. I expect that to be in the MLS Cup as well. And so,
I don't see any reason, Richard and Jeff, to expect that to change at this stage. It's been one of the longest 8 months of my life.
Well done, John. What do you expect in this final? In this city, there is a lot of enthusiasm for TFC, particularly just for how well they have played since June. They are probably nationally a bit of a surprise to be in the MLS Cup final, but if you watch them on a week-to-week basis, they've been really, really terrific now for a couple of months.
Well, they have, and this is a turnaround because they've had a pretty miserable 18 months, haven't they, since they lost the CONCACAF Champions League final so narrowly in a shootout, and it seemed they were heading in the wrong direction. They surprised everyone by missing out on the playoffs this time last year. This year, they've surprised the wider public, maybe not the localized Toronto public, by being so good in the back end of the season, as you've referred to, 13 games unbeaten, a club record, and really admirable performances, particularly going into the Lions' Den in Atlanta last time out, going to City Field to play New York City FC the game before that, and just gritting it out and having a game plan and sticking to it. And I think what they've benefited from more than anything else is that they are true course and distance specialist. This group of players, the core group, has been together for long enough, have been in a tight corner on so many occasions before, more often than not have emerged from it. And they've got a great record when it comes to one-off knockout occasions. Okay, they lost on penalties to the Sounders in 2016. In 17, they got revenge. This isn't going to phase them. And I think, really, they have shown themselves to have a very tough teak mentality in the closing months of the season. And that, above anything else, I think, has impressed me. It is the fact that they are the toughest of nuts to crack. And I think that's what Seattle are going to find on Sunday.
You know, it's interesting you mentioned about the, you know, sort of the one-and-done mentality of Toronto FC and their ability to play well in those games. Because, I mean, soccer, John, is one of those sports where, you know, you sort of do have horses for courses. And there's a different when you're coaching a two-legged final or a tournament, there's a different approach you take than when it's just a one-off. And I watch this team during these playoffs, and I almost get the sense that there's something about Greg Vanney's coaching style that maybe wears better when it's you know, win or go home.
I think so. I think he's a pragmatist. Mm-hmm. We're in a world of soccer coaches which is occupied largely by idealists, people that want their team to play like Barcelona or like Manchester City, and they think they can achieve that. And, of course, that's always going to be an elusive goal ultimately. But the others are the great pragmatists. I mean, to relate them to characters in European football, you'd look at people like Alex Ferguson, for so long the ever-so-successful manager of Manchester United, who wanted his team to play some beautiful stuff. But moreover, what he really wanted was his team to win, and he would go to any ends to achieve that. And I think Greg Vanney's got a bit of that about him. He is able to adapt a game plan. He's able to devise a game plan, which not all coaches are, for a specific one-off occasion. And that does seem to be serving them well. And you mentioned the one-off nature of the playoffs, which, of course, is a first for MLS mm-hmm. this season. I do think that has to be judged as a runaway success, because rather than the cloak of caution being thrown over so many of the end-of-season games, which should be part of an end-of-campaign jamboree, a celebration of Major League Soccer over the course of its 8.5-month season, so often they've been shrouded in caution in the past, and they've been miserable games to watch because of that. Here, the teams have been forced to be positive and to go for it in a one-off hit. And it's emerged now that we've had more goals in terms of average goals per game than ever before in the playoffs. And for that reason, I think a big tick to MLS for actually opting for this format.
Yeah, we agree on that for sure. John, when you watch Seattle at home, at least via the tube, it is an incredible atmosphere. That fan base, especially in stadium, they are just so into the game. I know they have their famous walk prior to the game. What kind of atmosphere do you expect, and how has Seattle fared in your mind as kind of a soccer market compared to some of the other MLS markets you've seen this year?
Well, I think it's one of those markets that points the way towards what the future of Major League Soccer hopefully is. Their 11th season, they came in 2009, and they were groundbreaking in the way that they set things up, the way that they were in alliance with the Seahawks under the ownership of Paul Allen at that stage, and the way that they decided that this was the best way to take a big stride forward, to sell it to a market that was eager to embrace professional soccer on a higher footing than it had ever been able to embrace it before, even dating back to the NASL days of the 1970s and early 1980s. One of the reasons that I was encouraged to take the job in the United States was the experience of coming over a couple of times with ESPN to commentate on games at CenturyLink Field. The first time I ever came here, 67,000 turned up to see them play a mid-season friendly against Tottenham, and I was engrossed by this. And I talked to people like Arlo White back in the UK, who obviously cut his American broadcasting teeth with the Sounders, and he said, look, when you go there, it's really something very special. And I was a little bit skeptical until I stepped into CenturyLink Field that day. It was just after the World Cup of 2014, and I was blown away by it. And I continue to be blown away by the match day experience of the Sounders. And of course, they're going to be doubly impressive this weekend, because we'll have double the crowd. 37,000 is the usual cap. They normally have four regular season games where they use the entire stadium. And tomorrow is going to be, Sunday rather, is going to be the biggest crowd ever to watch a professional sports event in CenturyLink Field. Seahawks or Sounders, just under 70,000.
Wow.
And we've just been meeting with Brian Schmetzer, the head coach, who's had to find 74 tickets for his family and friends for this game. And bearing in mind that when they put the tickets on sale at the start of the week, they sold out in 12 minutes. Wow. They had a waiting line of 20,000 people wanting tickets, even after they had sold out, and the website was overwhelmed and eventually crashed. And on the secondary market, in history in Seattle, only the NFC Championship game between the Seahawks and the 49ers has ever commanded higher prices than this.
Wow.
Sounds like it should be a great day, John. Thanks so much for joining us.
It's been a great pleasure. Lovely to talk to you.
Thanks, John. Take care.
John Champion, MLS play-by-play voice on ESPN, one of the truly great broadcasting voices out there. Think about that, 70,000 people in the secondary market other than an NFC Championship game.
That's awesome. I actually did not realize the number of people who were going to be at that game in terms of a sellout. The only, off the top of my head, the only MLS stadium that would be more is Atlanta, which like hits in the 75,000
right.
mark. But that is going to be an awesome atmosphere, yeah, especially pregame.
It'll be a great experience. We'll take a break, and then Mr. Deitch and myself will be back with more Writer's Block on Sportsnet 590 The Fan and 360.
Now, more Writer's Block on Sportsnet 590 The Fan. You got the power!
Brandeo, make sure you send out your guilty pleasure list on the twit machine. The tweet machine. A reminder, by the way, that you could win one of 50 $500 prize packs and qualify for our grand prize sports weekend getaway, which will include tickets to see both Toronto teams back-to-back. There's got to be like some sort of rights reason that we can't see the name of the I can see both Toronto teams back-to-back with a VTech wake-up call. This contest is open to Ontario residents only. Visit sportsnet.ca/590 for details. We will have, by the way, the Raptors-Clippers game on Monday on Sportsnet 590 The Fan, Sportsnet Ontario, and Sportsnet 1. The Raptors will play the Pelicans tonight. The Lakers Sunday, right? Pelicans tonight, Lakers Sunday, and then Clippers Monday. No, I got that wrong because there's a stop in Portland in between.
We'll look that up.
Anyhow.
But the that
point is Monday night. Yeah, we'll have the Clippers and Raptors.
Huge, good, big audience for that, too. People in this city are going to be really – I don't know the interest in L.A. The interest in this city should be really high.
Yeah, it'll be – we played this game with the round table last week, I think, or 2 weeks ago. I don't know if we really we played the game. If you could ask Kawhi one question,
right?
What would you ask him? I'm going to turn that around a bit.
If Kawhi could ask us a question,
what'd it do, baby? You could ask Doc Rivers a question about Kawhi. What would you ask him?
Well, what I would love to know is sort of really how the pursuit, like the behind the scenes of the pursuit. I think what I would ask Doc Rivers, and if he's going to answer me honestly, Jeff,
yes,
I would like him to describe in full detail about the Malibu meeting/dinner that they had, which seemed to close the deal for Kawhi. That's what I'd like to know, is what Doc said, what Kawhi said, and just sort of what that whole meeting, what that whole night was like. Because if you believe the accounts that have come out, and I have no reason not to, that seems to be the closing night. That's when it seemed like Doc left. It was really exciting. It was like, we're going to get this guy.
That really is kind of the only, I mean, it's probably really the only loose thread, eh? Because
Uncle Dennis.
Masai is kind of, Masai has suggested that there were demands made
right.
of this organization, that the organization was simply not comfortable meeting, and you kind of got the sense it wasn't Kawhi necessarily making those demands, or at least the demands weren't necessarily about Kawhi. So we got a couple of minutes left. It's a 5-game road trip. What do you, when this is all said and done, Richard, when this 5-game trip is over, they're finished in Dallas a week from tonight. What do you need to see in this trip? What is the thing you are looking for out of this trip? Trying to figure out who the 7 and 8, the sort of the tail end of the rotation, is that number one for you?
No. What's number one for me is I want to see competitiveness against two or three teams I think have legitimate finals aspirations in the Clippers, the Lakers, and the Trailblazers. So I want to see when faced with a serious upgrade in talent, Jeff. I want to see how they fare. And particularly, I want to see how they fare if they're close in a fourth quarter. Even if they lose, if they show the same mettle, which they, in my opinion, have shown early this year and certainly showed last year, if they stay competitive and they even get beat late, that's going to tell me something about this team. That's sort of number one. What I hope for the Raptors, and I think if you're a fan, what you have to hope for is, I think you got to hope for two and three or 3-2. I think asking for more than that is way too much. What you really don't want, Jeff, is you don't want an 0-5 road trip. You don't want like to get buried and then they come back here and they start thinking, oh man, like maybe we are nowhere near as good as we think we are without Kawhi and Danny Green.
Yeah, I think you look at this road trip. I think they take, this is just looking at it. I mean, I think they take one of two in L.A. I think they beat the Lakers. They should be able to win tonight. And I think they can beat Dallas. Portland, I think, might be an issue because that backcourt is really going to test Toronto. And I think that may be the game where we see that sort of lack of a third option out of the backcourt for the Raptors because of Patrick McCaw's injury really come to the forefront. Because when this team has played the Trailblazers in the past, its guard play has largely determined the outcome of the game. Yeah. Which is and that's not a newsflash. It's
great guards.
That's the way Portland is built.
Yeah, I think they win against the Pelicans. I actually think they're going to lose both LA games, and then I would love to see them take two in the Portland-Dallas one, but I think if you take one, I still think that's not a.
I'm with you. Two and three road trip. I'm happy. Yeah.
But I will say this:
I got to win tonight.
In terms of Lakers Clippers, the team I have a better feeling of them beating is the Lakers. I'm with you there. I don't think they're beating Clippers in that game. I just don't see it.
It's not that I have a hard time taking the Lakers seriously. There's something about the Lakers that I don't want to go all in on the Lakers.
No, I totally understand.
I don't even want to go half in on the Lakers. Like, I'm more comfortable with teams like Denver, the Clippers, Portland. Pick a team. Maybe not Houston so much. I don't know.
The Lakers are a weird team. I mean, Dwight Howard's playing big minutes for them. Yeah. They may be great, but they're odd. Let's put it that way.
Yeah. So, again, we'll have the Clippers and the Raptors on Monday. We'll get you set for that game. When we come back on Monday, we'll have the Monday roundtable as well. Back-to-back hockey. Saturday, the Leafs take on the Philadelphia Flyers at Scotiabank Arena. That game will be on CBC and Sportsnet Ontario. It'll be Hockey Night in Canada. Sunday, Rogers Hometown Hockey. The Leafs take on the Chicago Blackhawks. We'll have those games, or we'll have that game on Sportsnet 590, the Fan of Sportsnet. For Richard and myself, and all of us here at Writer's Block, have a great weekend.